Perfection is an inherently impossible goal, and it comes from a form of deficit, a form of lack. You can begin to see how downstream effects of perfectionism can be exhausting, can lead to mental health difficulties. I advocate in the final chapter of the book's universal basic income, because that just flips the purpose of work on its head. Rather than working for survival, now our jobs become part of our identity, part of our vocation, to striving for purpose and meaning, because our basic needs are underpinned. In the not too distant future, we have to reconcile with this focus of more, bigger, better.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Friends, I was so excited about today's episode. It's about a very specific topic which really resonates with me, and that is the role of perfectionism. I definitely identify as a perfectionist, although after talking to Thomas in today's episode, it sort of redefined for me what a perfectionist actually is, and maybe I'm not a perfectionist. I will say this conversation was so fascinating. We talk about different types of perfectionism, the differences in work versus vocation, the role of self-criticism and high standards. And this also may be my most political episode I've ever aired, which just goes to show how not political I am, because it's not even that political in today's episode. But we really had a really nice, respectful conversation around things like capitalism and universal basic income. And I just really, truly enjoyed this conversation. I can't thank Thomas enough for his work and for his openness and everything that he's doing. Definitely check out his book, The Perfection Trap, and definitely let me know what you think of today's episode. The show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/perfectionism. Those show notes will have a full transcript as well as links to everything that we talked about. So definitely check that out. And there will be two episode giveaways for this episode. One will be in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. Hey friends, did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them, and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/melanieavalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hi friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. All right, without further ado, please enjoy this fabulous conversation with Thomas Curran. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation that I'm about to have. It is about a topic that, backstory on today's conversation, it was one of those situations where I saw the pitch for the book and I was just, I only had to see a second of the title and I was an immediate yes. So I don't know about you guys, but I have personally, for pretty much my whole life, as long as this would be a thing, identified as a perfectionist. I never really saw it. Well, I guess we can talk about that. I feel like historically, I didn't see it as a negative. And then I probably started seeing it as a little bit draining and as a negative as far as like how intense I would get with focusing on things in life and the standards that I would hold for myself. More recently, it has felt less problematic because I feel like I've been able to let go of some of the negative tendencies of it. In any case, it's something that I really, really identify with. Like I use it to define myself. So when I saw the title of this book by Thomas Curran called The Perfection Trap, Embracing the Power of Good Enough, I was just like, yes, the psychology of perfectionism, please, please, please. And then reading Thomas's book was so fascinating, so eye-opening. Who knew? I mean, I clearly knew nothing about perfectionism. I had no idea that it was, well, A, so debated, B, that there were so many different potential manifestations of it and way it's been studied in the clinical literature, even though, as Thomas talks about in the book, it's been kind of existing in the world of, quote, pop psychology for a while. But I learned so much about the potential different manifestations of it, what it means for me and for you guys, and also what it actually might mean for our world and the future and sustainability. Like there is a lot to tackle here. So I am here today with Thomas. I am so honored to be here with him. He is a professor of psychology at the London School of Economics, and he actually did a landmark study on perfectionism that I'm sure we'll talk about in today's show. And he has a TED talk about it that he also talks about in the book. So Thomas, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. That was a wonderful introduction.
I've been looking forward to this for so, so long.
So many questions I have for you. But to start things off, a little bit about your personal story. You weave it in, you know, with different parts of your life relating to the different aspects of perfectionism as you talk about it in the book. Did you always identify? Because when I was just saying this right now in the intro, I was trying to think. I was like, well, when did I first like identify as a perfectionist? So did you always identify as one? Did you have a moment of epiphany where you realized you were one? Did you have a moment where you realized it wasn't a potentially a good thing for your life? What was your history with that?
Oh, goodness me. I was definitely a latecomer to perfectionism. But when I look back and reflect on my childhood and young adulthood, definitely there's a basic anxiety underneath a lot of my experiences. I worried a lot as a kid, how I looked, what I had, whether I was good enough. But I'm not sure whether those anxieties were channeled into perfectionism until later in life, when I somehow found myself in a, I suppose, middle-class professional, educated professional role, surrounded by high achievers. And suddenly that basic anxiety found its way into perfectionism and made me work really, really hard, but also contributed to a lot of mental health difficulties, which I'm sure we'll discuss later. But that was probably, I would say, the moment where I realized perfectionism was having a negative impact on my life, where those anxieties that I grew up with started to take over, pushing me into a lot of uncomfortable working habits, working evenings, weekends, doing work on my PhD dissertation at Christmas, and finding myself just all consumed, I suppose, by work and all the rest of it. So I was definitely a perfectionist, no doubt about that, but I definitely came to it later in life.
So that actually leads to a huge question I have. I want to lay down the foundation before I ask it, but as a teaser, because it's so interesting hearing you say that, because like for me with my perfectionism, like I said, it's literally the way, I mean, it's just the way I felt for as long as I can remember. I don't remember being any other way. Like it very much felt like it came from within me. So like self-oriented perfectionism. So it's interesting to hear with you that it was partly that social environment that seemed to kind of like activate it or catalyze it. So like, do you identify more? And again, this is why it needed a foundational explanation, because I'm using terms that we haven't defined yet. But like for you, was it more socially prescribed perfectionism?
Yeah, definitely. My perfectionism is social in its root and also social in its expression too. So I would say that there's definitely a high level of self-oriented in there, like self-driven perfection, but it comes from outside. So I felt a lot of social pressure to live up to really high expectations, which I then put on myself to push myself really, really hard. And so as I said, I think there was a predisposition that I held when I was younger, but I think that predisposition was waiting to be activated by the social world. And as soon as it was, it kind of exploded into some very, very unhealthy perfectionistic behaviors. So definitely social self, and there's another type of perfection called overwhelming perfectionism. All these types of perfectionism, they don't operate independently. They sort of bleed into each other, and we're higher on one, and a little bit maybe not quite as high on another, but typically if we're perfectionistic, we trend higher on most of them.
Can you go through that, like the three, because you talk in the book about, and what were their names, like Paul and Gord?
Paul Hewitt and Gordon Flett are the two researchers who've done most of the heavy lifting in this area, although their ideas come from earlier theorizing by many psychoanalysts, but particularly a psychoanalyst called Karen Horney. But over many, many years, they've just interviewed perfectionistic people, really talked to them and asked them what perfectionism looks like. And what's really interesting from their research is most of us think of perfectionism as, you know, the quintessential overstriver, the really hard worker who pushes themselves well beyond comfort. Now that's true. Perfectionistic people do that, and we see that time and time again, but it's not the full picture. So that's self-oriented perfectionism. Perfectionism comes from within. But they also were seeing time and time again, perfectionistic people describe a social kind or form of perfectionism, where perfectionism is coming from the outside. So not only do they impose high self-set standards on themselves, but also they feel like other people are expecting perfection of them. And this is called socially prescribed perfectionism, this idea that other people expect me to be perfect and they're waiting to pounce when I've shown a weakness or made a mistake. And not only do we see socially prescribed perfectionism, we also see perfectionism turned onto other people too. So when you talk to perfectionistic people, you'll often see perfectionists not only have high standards for themselves, but also high standards for other people. So, you know, if I'm hauling myself over coals to reach excessive standards, then you're going to do that too, right? That's only fair. So this is called other-oriented perfectionism. And these are the three core elements of perfectionism. You see time and time again in perfectionistic people. They're the basis for the measurement of perfectionism. And they're also the basis for our work looking at whether perfectionism is increasing over time.
The three of them, they're all about filling high standards. The self-oriented, that's coming from you, like your own desire to have these standards. The social is you feel like other people have these standards that you have to fulfill. And then the third one, the other, that's you putting your standards on other people.
That's right. Yeah. All of them have a consistent root, which is in a sense of deficit or a feeling of not being enough. But they are just triggered and manifest slightly differently depending on the dominant form of perfectionism at play. So if you're a highly self-oriented perfectionist, then you're going to feel a lot of self-criticism. You're going to put a lot of self-imposed pressure on yourself. If you're a socially prescribed perfectionist, you're going to experience a lot of those things too, but you're also going to feel a lot of social judgment. And you're going to feel like people are watching you all the time. And you're going to feel you need to please others, right? So there's a sense that I need validation from other people to really prop up my own self-esteem. And then other-oriented is really where it kind of what Freud would call projection. So this idea that, you know, I'm projecting my high standards onto you because I expect myself to be perfect. So you're going to need to be perfect too. So these different types of perfectionism all have that same root of feeling like we're not enough, but they're just expressed slightly differently depending on which one's dominant.
So, because you mentioned just now, like the negative effects and this idea of not feeling enough, how do you feel about people who categorize perfectionism rather than like these three versions instead into like a binary, like good versus bad perfectionism? Because you mentioned some of that dualistic categorizations in the book. And then last night I was just randomly like Googling studies and different studies would like call it different things, but a lot of them would put it into basically two types, like a more negative perfectionism and then like a more positive perfectionism. So how do you feel about that sort of categorization of it?
This is a heated debate still going on in the academic literature. So my perspective on this shouldn't be taken as gospel. However, from what I understand about perfectionism, from the many years I've done this work and from my own experiences with perfectionism, I've come to the conclusion that there is no such thing as positive or healthy or adaptive perfectionism. These are kind of the terms that you'll see time and time again. You know, perfection is an inherently impossible goal. And it comes from a form of deficit, a form of lack. So that when we've failed and made mistakes or shown vulnerability, which we do all the time, that has a massive impact on our self-esteem, which plummets. We go in on ourselves, we're very critical, and ultimately it creates a lot of mental health difficulties that we see time and time again in the literature. And even when we succeed, on the flip side, let's say we do something well, there's no lasting satisfaction that comes from those accomplishments because perfectionism will keep us pushing for more. Keep us overcompensating for what we lack. The better we do, the better we feel like we're expected to do. And so it's an unwinnable game. There's no joy in the wins, and there's intense amounts of self-criticism and self-loathing when we fall short. And so as a consequence, I don't think we can make a case that perfectionism is in any way positive or adaptive. And I think what we're seeing in positive and adaptive perfectionism is perhaps slightly different to what perfectionism's essence is. I think what we're seeing there is conscientiousness, meticulousness, diligence. And these things are very good things to possess, but they don't come with the insecurity that comes with perfectionism. Perfectionism is really insecurity fused with high standards, and high standards don't need to come with insecurity. And I think we have to make that distinction when we're debating whether perfectionism is positive or negative.
One of the studies I was reading last night, it actually was talking about, I should actually find it. It mentioned the terminology they were using. Let me just see, because I think I have it right here. Oh yeah, here it is. They were like dividing perfectionism into conscientiousness perfectionism, which you just mentioned, and self-evaluative perfectionism. They said that came from neuroticism, sort of similarities. And so I guess the question there is distinguishing conscientiousness and perfectionism. So when people are having these debates, do some people, when they're having these debates, not separate like conscientiousness and perfectionism. It's just, it's hard to like have the conversation when people are using different terminology and like different definitions, I guess.
100%. I can't imagine what it's like for people who don't work in this area to come to and try to figure out. It's hard enough for those who do research in this area to work through it. You know, there's so many different terms and so many different perspectives. And this, by the way, this is a very healthy thing for science. It's good to have debates and it's good for people to come to different conclusions. Social science and psychology as a social science, it is not a hard and fast, this is not physics or biology where we can identify the etiology of things precisely. We're dealing with abstract constructs here. And so at a certain level, we have to rely on abstract theories and ideas and yes, perspectives and opinions to guide us in our understanding of the topic. And as I mentioned, my understanding of the topic comes from personal experience, but also many, many years working in the research, trying to figure out what on earth this thing is. And having done that process, I've come to the conclusion that I think we have to be very clear as researchers about what perfectionism is and differentiate it from similar characteristics. And there's no doubt, there's a lot of overlap between conscientiousness and perfectionism, no doubt about that. But there's also crucial differences. And it's the starting point, it's where those high conscientious, high standards come from that I think is important. And if you start from a place of deficit and lack, which is where perfectionism comes from, rather than a place of active and optimistic wanting to do more, you know, to improve, to grow, which is conscientiousness, I think if we can get the starting point right, then you can begin to see how downstream effects of perfectionism can be exhausting, can lead to mental health difficulties, can be unsustainable ways of striving, whereas conscientiousness, growth mindset, and all those, I guess you might call them positive things, because they come from a very active and optimistic place of wanting to grow, well, their downstream effects are likely to be much more positive, much more adaptive, lead to much more long-term and sustainable forms of striving.
Like I took a personality test sort of recently, and it was for the main, I should know this better, the main personality traits like conscientiousness, extroversion, introversion, neuroticism, like all of those things. And I was 100% in conscientiousness, which makes sense given my perfectionism identification. Could you be conscientious and not be trying to achieve perfect standards? I'm just trying to like get a better picture of this. And like, here's a thought experiment, not to throw two questions at you, because I think when we're talking about perfectionism, we're thinking about like work, like doing things perfectly and things like that. But that idea of doing something to 100% is that idea perfectionism. So like an analogy would be like, I want to be a kind person. Shouldn't I aim to be perfectly kind? Like shouldn't, otherwise, what do I aim for? That I'm going to be 97% kind? And like, does that make me a perfectionist?
It's a recognition though. Perfectionists are singularly unable to recognize that life is messy, that we are imperfect people and we live on an imperfect planet. And we're going to make mistakes because we're fallible. We're going to slow down and feel sometimes like things are too much because we're exhaustible. And occasionally there's going to be times where we just screw up. And there was nothing to learn, nothing we could have done. It was just simply having a bad day, or we simply just took our eye off the ball for that second and we made a mistake. These are things that are part and parcel of being human. And perfectionism and the perfectionistic mindset makes being human almost the hardest thing to accept. Whereas conscientiousness is different. It's about trying to do our level best. It's about putting in effort to and being meticulous to try to master things. Conscientiousness is almost like having a vocation. Your life's purpose is to try to master a task. My grandfather was a carpenter. I reflect a lot of his experience in the book because he was a very conscientious person, but he wasn't a perfectionist. He could leave his things in the world for other people to use, and he could go home and not worry about it. And if somebody gave him a bad review, or you know, he would just made a mistake on the job, these weren't catastrophic things in his life. But perfectionistic people are unable to have that kind of stillness and that acceptance because they are fighting against their imperfect humanity all the time, trying to conceal, hide those things that deep down we know are imperfect about us. And that's, I think that has, that is the crucial distinction between somebody who's perfectionistic and somebody that holds high standards or maybe conscientious. And it's really conscientiousness fused with insecurity, which is perfectionism. But conscientiousness on its own is an eminently positive thing.
So if a person were trying to achieve, quote, perfect standards, but they are okay not meeting them, they don't have anxiety about it, they don't feel hard on themselves, that type of manifestation would be conscientiousness, not perfectionism, if they're not experiencing the negative effects.
Yeah, let me give you an example. We do many experiments in the lab. And one of the things we're really interested in is what happens when you put perfectionists in situations of failure. And what you see time and time again is people who are lower on perfectionism, in particular self-oriented, but certainly socially prescribed perfectionism too. If you give them a task and you tell them they failed, no matter how well they did, you just say that you didn't quite reach the target or other people perform better than you. You see something really fascinating in terms of their emotional responses to that setback. Non-perfectionistic people or not very perfectionistic people, look, they've just tasted defeat. They're going to feel, you know, at some level disappointed in that. Their pride might fall a little bit. They might feel a little bit of elevation in their guilt and shame. But it's fleeting. You know, it's not lasting. They can come through that very, very quickly. In other words, they bounce back from that setback. However, people who are higher on perfectionism, every single time you do this, their pride plummets in themselves. Their shame in particular spikes really, really high, as does their guilt. And it stays like that for a long time. It lingers inside them. And that's the crucial difference. Perfectionism is really riven by insecurities, worries, doubts about other people seeing what they consider to be their shameful interiors. And the moment those interiors are revealed to the world, the moment we hit a mistake or setback, the internal dialogue is, how could you be so stupid? What were you thinking? And that ruminative, brooding mindset can go on for days, weeks, even months, depending on how big the mistake is. And that's the crucial difference. And we see this time and time again in the lab.
With the perfectionism and those experiences that you see in the lab.
Hey friends, I am about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com.
Are you also ranking the people on other potential mediators that could lead to that manifestation, like their anxiety independent of the perfectionism, or like their emotional intelligence, or their, I guess what I'm trying to get a sense of is, how do we know the issues are coming from the perfectionism and it's not third party character traits about the people that makes issues manifest from the perfectionism?
These are really good questions. And the answer is, in a lot of the work that we do, you know, you can try and control for what we think are important variables in those lab situations, but you can't control for everything. We don't know the background of participants in intimate detail. We can't possibly measure every other potential third variable that could impact on the relationship between perfectionism and self-conscious emotions. We try as hard as we can to make sure that the conditions are as controlled as possible so that what we see at the end can be as far as is within the bounds of the design of the experiment is perfectionism. But, you know, you're absolutely right. This is not just a legitimate question to be asked of our field. It's a legitimate question to be asked of every field of psychology. And the extent to which we can say that X causes Y has to be considered in the context of potential explanations. Having said all that, there is now a huge body of literature in our field that finds time and time and time and time again very, very strong correlations between perfectionism and indicators of serious mental illness, things like anxiety, depression, self-harm, bulimia, image-related concerns, particularly body image concerns, self-conscious emotional responses to failure, which is the research I've talked about. And so, you know, correlation doesn't equal causation. This is true. But once many, many, many correlations tend in the same direction, we can say that something is happening here that it's probably worth us paying attention to when it comes to perfectionism and its problematic relationship, which should we say, with mental health.
And it's a little bit difficult because we're, again, using the word perfectionism when earlier we said there were three different ones that we are going to define it as. So like in those studies and when they find those negative effects, which in the book, and by the way, friends, get the book because all the information and details and studies and everything is in there. So you'll get all the data. So in those studies, when they find those negative effects, how do they correlate to the three different types? And also, do they ever isolate the three different types and look for those effects? So like if there's a person who's just self-oriented, do they have those effects? A person who's just socially, do they have those effects? Which I know the answer to that one. And then if there's a person who's just other oriented, do they experience those effects?
Yeah, this is what we do all the time. Although I would caution, this is kind of a problematic way of doing this kind of research, because if you strip socially the variance that's shared between socially described and self-oriented perfectionism, you just look at pure self-oriented perfectionism, then what you're doing is you're creating a bit of a straw man, because there's no perfectionistic person that would only 100% associate with being a self-oriented perfectionist. This is, as I mentioned earlier, these forms of perfectionism can bleed into each other. And yes, people tend higher on one relative to the other, but they've got positive correlations with each other, which means if you have one, you're likely to also have a little bit of another. However, that caveat said, we do the work, we look at the independent effects of these forms of perfectionism. And what you see is socially prescribed perfectionism being the most extreme, the one that correlates most strongly with really quite serious mental health conditions. And I think there's no surprise, really, if you've, you know, socially prescribed perfectionism is really about trying to please other people, hyper-vigilance for other people's approval and validation. And when we've screwed up or we make mistakes, particularly publicly, then the ruminative cognition, the brooding that occurs, the things that I've just mentioned in those experiments, you know, left unchecked, that can create some really problematic mental health outcomes, particularly anxiety, particularly low mood, particularly depression and image-related concerns. Socially prescribed is very much not something that we would like to see in people, particularly at high levels, because that can have some negative impact. Now, self-oriented is a bit more complicated, because self-oriented can sometimes seem positive. Like, so you'll sometimes see positive relationships with self-esteem, positive emotions. You might see negative relationships, small negative relationships with anxiety or depression, you know. So on the surface, when you look at socially prescribed affections and self-oriented without socially prescribed, it can seem ostensibly positive. But then when you look at the effects of self-oriented over time, you tend to see those relationships reverse. Now we start to see positive relationships, anxiety and depression over time. And then when you look at self-oriented perfectionism without taking out the impact of socially prescribed, you tend to see much weaker relationships with those positive outcomes, even in some cases, positive relationships with more negative outcomes. So self-oriented is a lot more complex, but nevertheless, when you study it over time, you tend to see some negative impacts come through. So socially prescribed is uniformly negative. It has massive negative impacts on mental health. And then other-oriented is a much less studied than the other two. But what studies have been conducted have looked at other-oriented in terms of relational outcomes. So how satisfied are you in your relationships, at work, in your personal relationships with friends, et cetera, et cetera. And you see time and time again that other-oriented perfectionism correlates to things like interpersonal hostility, less satisfaction in romantic relationships, less satisfaction in professional relationships. And that can have an impact on things like loneliness and social connection. So that's what we know from the literature.
I remember reading in the book, you were talking about how self-oriented perfectionism did correlate in a lot of studies to self-esteem and happiness, but then also that there are these other issues as well. It's interesting to hear that the timeline, how you were saying that it typically gets worse, because I guess in my experience, although again, maybe I need to use different definitions or words, but like I said, in my experience, it was kind of like the timeline I gave earlier where I always identified as this growing up, and then I feel like I did start experiencing negative traits. But then I feel like as I grew, like worked on myself and like matured and maybe became more emotionally mature as well, I feel like it was like been the opposite timeline that you gave, in that I've been able to identify the issues and work on them. So it's interesting that it's more common to go the other way, that people tend to get worse with it.
Well, it's interesting because it's very important to say that these effects are only when these tendencies are left unchecked. And, you know, from my own experience, it's the same as yours in some ways, but it took me, it took me to a mental health breakdown to realize. So there's kind of a curvilinear relationship, I think, that we might see in particularly people with really high self-oriented perfectionism, where in the initial stage is a sense that we need this, it has to be like this, and we have to push ourselves really, really hard. And I suppose tolerate the mental health difficulties that come with it. But it's only when we get to a certain point where we can't keep going and things feel like they're coming down, where we have to take a minute to reflect. And when we do that, we begin to see that actually the way we're doing things is unsustainable. It's putting a great deal of pressure on ourselves. It's making us feel miserable and all the rest of it. And then you turn the corner. Certainly my story. But if you don't get on top of it, then self-oriented perfectionism can run away with you.
So many questions for you. The role of culture and environment. So because it seems like like socially oriented perfectionism, for example, if you're just looking at it really casually and externally, it would seem that certain jobs and positions might encourage it more. It would seem like lower ranking jobs would make people more socially prescribed because there's an external pressure literally forcing them into, you know, having to be a certain thing, compared to higher ranking where maybe they have more independence. So maybe that's not as much of a factor. That's what it would seem like on the outside. But then I'm wondering if maybe that doesn't relate at all. And it's literally your internal perspective of what people think of you, regardless of status. And then I know in the book, you talk about how the stress can actually be worse for people who are more, quote, affluent. What is the role of somebody's actual job and the society and culture they're living in?
Absolutely. Look, you know, one of the things I wanted to do in the book was to take a slightly different lens to this issue. A lot of the things that have been written in the past about perfectionism are very individual focused, which is fine. But that's not the complete story. I mean, my research raised the prominence on the back of research that showed perfectionism rising for everybody. And so, you know, that's not an individual defect or something that's going wrong within individuals, but it tells us that something is happening in broader society that's making or pushing people to endorse these tendencies to a greater degree. And in particular, socially prescribed perfectionism. That's the one that's rising really, really fast among young people. So I think we have to zoom out a little bit. Of course, there are individual differences that people possess that mean they're more predisposed to perfectionistic tendencies than others, and we shouldn't discount them. And of course, there are early life experiences, things like abuse and neglect, which are also important to this perfectionism story, absolutely. However, in the aggregate, I think what we're also seeing is something significant that isn't talked about as much, and that's that society is becoming more pressurized. Society is projecting perfect ideals into the world through things like social media, excessive pressures in schools and colleges, the workplace, as you've mentioned there, becoming extremely pressurized and requiring excessive levels of work ethic and pushing and all the rest of it to succeed. And then, of course, you know, you've got changing parenting practices and the proliferation of digital media, not just social media, but also TV, documentaries, billboards, all these sort of forms of advertising that together conspire to create a society and a culture that kind of idolizes perfectionism, that pushes us to set ourselves excessive expectations and ideals. And I think the reason why I make the point in the book that this is something that perhaps is coming for more affluent communities in it to a greater degree is that those are the communities where these standards and expectations are really intense and really fierce. And you see that in, you know, schools, colleges, but you also see that in the workplace too. So I don't think the perfectionism spares anyone, but I do think it's a particular problem for those on the upper end of the social hierarchy.
It's crazy timing because while I was reading your book, the other show I was prepping, do you know the work of Dr. Loretta Bruning by chance?
I don't.
She's done a lot on, well, psychology, but in particular, how our like quote happy hormones like dopamine and endorphin, serotonin, oxytocin, how they work and how we relate to the animal kingdom. So basically how these manifest in animals versus us and evolution and all that. She has so many books. And her most recent book is called Why You're Unhappy. I think it's the subtitle is something about politics and biology. Her thesis, the reason I'm talking about it, her thesis is basically the polar opposite of yours. So it was so interesting to be reading your book and her book at the same time, because the argument she makes is that we blame society for our unhappiness or our mental health issues. But really, it's like the way we are. Like, we're made to be driven by these dopamine drips, and we're made to be unhappy when it drips, and then we're made to be happy when we get the boost. And like, that's the way it is in animals too. And that's the way it is in hierarchies with serotonin. And that was like a long-winded intro to saying, how do you feel about people who say that this is just blaming society for our own issues that would be there regardless? And like, were these issues, like, when did perfectionism start appearing historically? Like, is it, I know you said it's increasing, but did it not exist in the past?
Well, I mean, I haven't read the work, so I would have to...
You don't have to respond to her specifically.
I'd have to read it in more detail. I mean, look, there are many people that would say, you know, this is completely individual and we can just think ourselves happy. I mean, look, I come from a working class background. I grew up around poverty. There is a lot of that that comes into my thinking. I think if you grew up in those situations, you realize that, you know, we can say that it's up to individuals to pull themselves out of situations that they're in, but sometimes the situations are so dire that it's almost impossible. You know, I grew up with friends who had terrible, terrible situations that, you know, that I could not say that I would be able to have overcome them. You know, we're talking here drug abuse, alcohol abuse, absent parental figures. You know, these are really tough social circumstances that that I think when we say it's just the individual and it's up to you to overcome these hurdles or issues of neglect and abuse, I think that sometimes that misses an important part of every human experience. And that's kind of this idea that, you know, by the grace of God, go I. Sometimes we get lucky and we are able to reach the top and be in positions where we have, you know, some kind of say, or we don't. And I think it's important for me as somebody who's come from that background to reflect on, you know, this isn't just about individual experience. It's also a complex interaction between our circumstances, luck, happenstance, who we interact with, where we come, happen to come through the education system at the right time. There are all sorts of many, many factors that impact on our success, our health and our happiness. And to put it all on the individual, I think, is disingenuous. Now, that's just my opinion coming from personal experience. I haven't read this person's work, so I'm sure that there is a strong evolutionary case to suggest that there are certainly natural impulses for people to feel like we lack something, that we need to do more, that we need to work harder, and the rest of it. And I can certainly have that debate. But when it comes to what we know about society, the inequalities that are present in society, and having experienced that myself, it's really difficult for me to fall down totally on the individual case. Now, my argument is, and this is the same argument as psychoanalysts going back decades, so this goes to the history part of your question. Perfectionism isn't a new phenomenon. It's not something that has just emerged in the last 20 years. Many, many philosophers, psychoanalysts, sociologists, anthropologists have observed in all sorts of different places and cultures. And I'm very much guided by the seminal work of someone called Karen Horney, who essentially observed time and time again in patients that were seeing her back in the sort of 30s, 40s, 50s when she was practicing, a consistent tension, a consistent neurosis, particularly in women, who was born of something called internal conflict between the person we actually are, you know, the imperfect, exhaustible, fallible person we actually are, and the person society tells us we should be. And of course, that those pressures and those conflicts were particularly heavy on women, who were expected to hold, you know, ideals that were completely out of line with unrealistic. And over time, she saw this time and time again, this internal conflict time and time again, that she came to the conclusion that these were cultural neuroses, right? These are cultural tensions that were placed upon us by living in a society that makes us bend ourselves to the whim of societal norms. And as a consequence, a lot of the neurosis that she saw and a lot of the perfection that she saw came from trying to bridge the gap between the imperfect person we are and the perfect person we're told we should be. And that was the tension that was at the root of a lot of psychological difficulties. And I think if we take Karen Horney's ideas of that inner conflict to the present day, it makes a lot of sense that what we're seeing here is a disconnect between what we feel we should be in this society, this kind of the idealized version of who we should be, and the imperfect person we are. And that's creating a lot of difficulty, a lot of tension, particularly on young people who are finding it much more difficult in today's society to live up to the ideal of the ideal person who they've told they should be in social media advertising, or even their parents. It's really, and for me, that really is just as important part of the conversation as any individual impulse or, you know, evolutionary take on why it is we feel unhappy.
And with Karen Horney's work, and that idea of, you know, it being these cultural manifestations that we need to achieve, how far back in culture, like, when did she think that first started?
Well, Karen Horney was a neo-Freudian, so she wrote a lot about a lot of critiques of Freudian psychology. Because she said that, you know, these biological drives that Freud described are, you know, confined to the people that he was working with, i.e., you know, Northern Europeans. And actually, they may not exist in people from other cultures and other societies, which is what got her thinking about how a lot of mental health difficulties and neuroses are not just, you know, individually predetermined, that's to say, that come from basic anxieties that we're born with, but also cultural pressures. And so, you know, she was really dealing with a lot of the issues that Freud was raising, and you can go back to the turn of the century, and then you can go back even further, looking at how, you know, philosophers and poets and people in popular literature talked about perfectionism back through the years. I mean, I start my book with a tale about two Gothic writers, Hawthorne and Poe, who wrote really, you know, vividly about the dangers of living life trying to emulate perfectionistic ideals, and how ultimately that can lead to a very empty and unfulfilling life. So, you know, and you go back to the philosophers, Aristotle and all the rest of it, that also dealt with issues about perfection and divinity. And I think, you know, it doesn't matter how far back you go, there were people dealing with these issues around perfection, the attainability of perfection, and how healthy it is to strive for perfection. But my book is really about what's going on in the last 20 years, which I think have created what we're seeing in the data, this rise of socially prescribed perfectionism. And that's where most of my ideas, I suppose, experiences, opinions, and research has centered. But yeah, I mean, look, this isn't a new phenomenon.
Hi, friends. Would you like to have the most epic eating experience? I'm talking eradicate bloating and better absorb your nutrients. If so, you need digestive enzymes. These are one of my most favorite supplements out of everything I take, and I truly cannot imagine my life without them. Digestive enzymes are key to break down your food into usable nutrition and to stop things like bloating, digestive distress, constipation, all the things. That's why I created Avalon X Digest, and you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. You can also get a subscription and save 15%, which you can pause or cancel at any time. Friends, I worked so hard to create the perfect blend of enzymes for Avalon X Digest. It's a full-spectrum, plant-based enzyme blend with proteases to help you break down protein, amylase for carbs, lipase for fats, cellulase for fiber, and so much more. In fact, there are 13 different types of enzymes in this blend. I cannot tell you how many people have told me that when they take Avalon X Digest, they experience no digestive distress with meals. These are truly game changers. And for any of you guys looking to up your protein intake, Avalon X Digest will help you actually break down and assimilate your protein so you get more protein from your meals. I wanted to create the highest potency enzymes so that you get all of these benefits when you eat with no problematic fillers or ingredients. Avalon X Digest is also tested multiple times for purity and potency, comes in glass bottles, and is truly the best enzymes on the market. And again, you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us.
The reason I was thinking about the history of it is I was wondering if there were cultures historically where this didn't manifest at all because the culture just didn't create a culture that would encourage it. And the crazy thought I had from that, although, for example, and I know, like you just said, your book is focusing on now, I'm just trying to create or just think about ideas here. So like, do we think that there's perfectionism in cultures that we idealize as being free from the woes of modern society and humanity? So like, we'll idealize the Native American culture or indigenous tribes or hunter-gatherers. Like, do we think there's perfectionism in those types of situations? And this leads to a different question I have.
I don't know is the answer. What would say is this: we are living developed economies that have at some level risen to a level of development on the back of scarcity. That's to say, we figured out how to create surplus value. And that has driven huge, huge strides in economic development. It's in the wealthy world, in developed countries, it's a remarkable achievement of capitalism. There's no doubt about that. We've accumulated vast, vast amounts of capitalism, capital way more than even the early pioneers could have ever imagined. It's a vast success story. And I suppose what we're talking about in the developed world is elements of degree, you know, degree of scarcity, how much scarcity is necessary to drive enough economic activity to meet the basic needs of people. The Scandinavian countries take a very different approach to the Anglo countries. They both have market-based societies. They both operate a capitalist economy. but they don't do it in the same way. And so what you tend to, you know, tend to see in America is it's kind of full voltage capitalism, no government, and everything is about economic growth. Whereas the Scandinavian countries and some European countries say, yeah, you know, the market is important, growth is important, but at the same time, it shouldn't come at the expense of human needs. And there are trade-offs. And it's important that we have social protections. And it's important that we recognize that growth that we accumulate is reasonably shared so that most people can enjoy the prosperity that comes from it. Those are two different degrees of focus on growth, more, bigger, better, that mean we're going to see a lot more perfectionistic tendencies in those where capitalism is on hyperdrive versus those where there is a fire blanket put around the excesses of capitalism that creates protections for people so that perfectionism isn't as necessary in those societies. And, you know, this is just the developed world we live in. And so that's where my thinking is oriented, because those are the societies that we must live in. Now, whether, you know, it's the same going back hundreds of thousands of years, I would argue probably not. If you look at the, you know, you look at the map of GDP, it starts to just spike around the Industrial Revolution, which means for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years, we lived in agrarian societies where sustainability was the focus. You know, there wasn't, we weren't chasing surplus value. We were creating communities to survive that were self-sufficient. You know, and I would argue, and I have no data for this because there is no possible way to collect data, but I would argue you will not see neuroses about whether we're good enough in those societies. Worries about whether we're doing enough or having enough or being enough. You know, these societies run on the premise that, you know, if we have enough, then that's plenty. And I'm not sure we'd see these excessive levels of perfectionism in those societies. But what I do know is that we do see a lot of perfectionism in modern societies, but we're talking about degrees. Some societies you'll see more of it, some societies you'll see less of it, and it depends on where you are. And I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the way I see this problem.
No, it does. And the crazy question I had from it, which is not about just perfectionism per se, but it just got me thinking, because what I was trying to get to was, you know, are there societies where this perfectionism concept doesn't even really exist because of the culture? And then I was just thinking, in general, does that mean there are other potential, and I don't know if you would qualify perfectionism as a personality trait, but are there other personality traits that we literally don't have a concept of right now that could exist if society was a certain different way, which like kind of blows my mind? Or have we experienced the entire potential mosaic of personality traits that there can be? Or are there ones that we have no idea about because we just don't live in that society?
It's a really good question. I don't know. Again, I don't know. It's a great question. Something I've never really thought about too deeply. You know, there's so much we know about human behavior and psychology, but there's also so much we don't know. And I think it's really important to recognize that psychologists, neurologists, anthropologists, sociologists, you know, all we have is a set of theories and ideas about how we think human psychology works. We could be wrong. We could be right. All we can do is do the research, present the data, make our arguments, and then move on to the next study. That's how science works. And what happens in the future is unknown. And I think that's important for listeners to recognize, actually. You know, I think we can take a lot of social science at face value, and we can read these wonderful books, so many wonderful books, and think that's the answer. But I think as you're doing in this interview, I think we should all engage with a bit of healthy skepticism and ask probing questions, because it's really, really important if we want to get to the nub of these issues. And people bring all sorts of experiences, biases to their work, no different from me. I wear them on my sleeve, which I suppose maybe is different to other researchers in the area. I'm very upfront about my experiences and how they shape the way I see the world. I'd say that's less true for other books and work in this area. But nevertheless, I do think it's important that we do maintain a healthy degree of skepticism. And what we know today might be very different to what we know in the future. Your question is one I can't answer, but I think it's a good one. And I think it is a good one to reflect.
Well, that perspective you have is overwhelmingly refreshing. And well, it's ironic to say you're the perfect guest for this show, but that's like the mindset that I just am so thankful to engage with people, because I just think it's so important. And so you do talk a lot, you talked about it now, and you talk about in the book a lot about this, you know, capitalism, a supply side economy, focus on growth, you know, reliance on credit and debt. Have there been studies? You also mentioned very briefly, you dropped in the word vocation, you know, versus job. Is having, I'm meandering all over the place, this economy that we're in now, like you were saying, it does create this constant focus on work and, you know, having to be productive and working all the time. And this is the bias I'm coming from, because this is all coming from my bias as well. Like, I love working. Like, it's like my favorite thing. So like when you were proposing in the book, you know, this idea of reduced workload or hours, I was like, no, I love working. So my question is, does it matter, or are there studies on perfectionism? Because I know you talk a lot about studies about perfectionism and work and the negative interplay there and the negative effects of working too much. What about people who enjoy working, or people who, if you identify as a vocation rather than a job, is that kind of like opting out of the society narrative about work, and then do you not potentially experience as much of the effects? What are your thoughts on working, jobs versus vocations, and loving work?
You know what? Like, again, it's a really good question. I'm not advocating, you know, a standard, everybody must now work 20 hours rather than 40. I think if you find work enjoyable, fulfilling, and it gives you purpose and meaning, then you should work as much as you want to work. Again, you know, this is my bias, but I come from a working class community where work isn't like that. You know, work is to make ends meet. Work is to put food on the table. And there's not enough of it. And there's not to do those things increasingly. And so, you know, when we talk about work, when I talk about work and reflect on work, you know, I reflect on my parents who were doing 3-4 jobs just to put food on our tables when we were younger and still struggling. You know, there wasn't any purpose or meaning beyond survival. And then we have to be also really careful about that it isn't just the sort of middle class jobs that we enjoy where, you know, I'm talking about here. I'm talking about, you know, jobs for people who are working themselves to the bone and still not finding that their ends meet. And that's just as important for us to recognize that work, when we work for survival, is very different to what it should be. It should be about purpose and meaning. It should be about fulfillment. And that's why I advocate in the final chapter of the book something called universal basic income, because that just flips the purpose of work on its head. Rather than working for survival, now, our jobs become part of our identity, part of our vocation, because we don't have the sword of scarcity hanging over us, that we can push ourselves into areas where of work that we find we have impact on the world, whether that be in caring for other people, whether that be creating things for people to use, whether that be repairing people's piping or roofs or whatever. This is work now is unleashed because it gives us a sense of purpose and meaning and vocation. And that goes hand in hand with this idea of working less, because what we're having now is going to be an era of AI, which is going to be complete disruption. Is going to take away millions of white collar jobs, and we have to reckon with that. Like, you know, how are we going to use the productivity gains that come from AI in a way that doesn't completely put millions and millions of people into poverty? Well, the way that we do it is through universal basic income, again, which is why I think it's such a great idea. But also, it's about, okay, this is going to take away work that's drudgerous, that's very difficult or arduous, and it's going to unleash us to do other creative things. And if we can take AI and it allows us to use our work in creative and innovative ways, then again, that's a very, very positive thing. And if we can use it to work less and spend more time in our families and with our communities, that's also a really, really positive thing. I suppose what I'm saying is we have an economy that's huge. We have a lot of affluence and we've got a lot of growth to come, particularly with the advent of AI. And I just think we have to think smartly and cleverly about how we use that. And if people want to work really, really hard, that's up to them. Great. But that doesn't mean that we have to do those things, because we have the technologies and the policies that are available to allow us not to. And if that means that we become happier, we live more fulfilling and contented lives, particularly for people at the bottom, then I think that's an eminently positive thing. And by the way, it will also mean that we won't need perfectionism just to get by. We'll be driven by purpose and fulfillment instead. Like, you know, this sounds utopian, but the tools are there and they're being developed It's just whether we use them to enrich the lives of people or whether we use them to enrich shareholder value. And that's a choice we have to make.
So in that hypothetical situation, because you just said how perfectionism, we would be driven by purpose and fulfillment instead. So do you think that that situation of universal basic income would equally affect the three types? So for self-oriented, so people who have these internal standards of not feeling like they are enough, how does that external situation of universal basic income affect that core belief?
Less so than the social, absolutely. But the real issue that we're dealing with is the social, because that's the one that's exploding. And I think that's the one we need to pay attention to. You know, perfectionism at root comes from a sense of not being enough, of lacking in some way. And that has been the engine of economic activity in the capitalist era. You know, scarcity is what's created to drive economic progress. And I'm saying that we've reached a point in our economic development where we don't have to continue to do that, where we can switch to a different way of driving innovation instead, focusing less on growth at all costs, and more on human indicators of progress, whether we're happier, healthier, whether we're living longer lives and all the rest of it. And part of that equation, I think, is universal basic income, because it, as I said, it flips a reason for living in society on its head, from survival striving to striving for purpose and meaning, because our basic needs are underpinned by a universal basic, which, by the way, is universal, right? Everybody gets it. It doesn't discriminate. And it frees us. This is why, by the way, it's advocated not just by people who come from the left, but also people who come from the right, because they realize that it really has tremendous potential to drive incredible innovation and economic growth. So I think, again, it's really about perfectionism for me comes from living in a society, in a society where we're told all the time that we're not enough, that we have to continually do more. Right, that's what feeds those perfectionistic neuroses that feed the need to keep moving forward, to keep driving, to keep pushing us as well beyond comfort. And a lot of that is socially prescribed. And I'm saying, okay, how can we take a slightly different approach to what drives people? And instead of driving them from below through, you know, this idea of, you know, scarcity driving people forward, how can we take a different approach that eradicates that scarcity and frees us to pursue purpose and meaning instead?
Is there the potential, because people have made the argument that a reason we have these mental health issues in general and more chronic stress, and I don't know if specifically they talked about perfectionism, but I would include that in it as well, is because we're not as having to focus on our basic needs as much, it frees up time to stress about other things. So like basically if you're literally, you know, if you're like a hunter-gatherer, you have to like find your food. So like that's your focus. Like you don't have time to stress about these other things. So is there potential that that situation could actually have the opposite effect, where by taking care of our basic needs, now we just have time to stress about other things?
It depends what the focus is, right? Like, I mean, I'm saying in the book that for these things to work, we also need a radical shift in perspective. And that, by the way, that is the utopian part of the book, i.e. that we've recognized that wanting, needing, craving, yearning for more is a kind of fleeting, very meaningless conditions that, you know, that bring a lot of unhappiness, chronic unhappiness. And so if all you do by implementing something like universal basic income is implement a floor under poverty and do nothing else in society in terms of, you know, radical perspective shift, then of course, you know, it may be the case that what you've described there is likely to happen. But the shifts that I'm describing, I think come at the same time as us recognizing that we're in a completely new phase of economic development, where essentially, you know, we have a size of an economic pie where most of human needs can be met if that pie is reasonably shared. The reason they're not, the reason we still see incredible poverty, massive mental health difficulties, drug addiction, high levels of incarceration, and all the things that we associate actually with poorer countries is is because the economic pie is not reasonably shared, and we have a very lopsided society where the proceeds of growth go overwhelmingly to a very small portion of people. So this, you know, these changes don't just come in independent of each other. The reason why I've tried to describe a whole perspective shift and a number of policies around that, not just one, is that all of these things really need to occur hand in hand for us to be able to live in a society where perfectionism wasn't required. And as I mentioned, the starting point for that wouldn't just be this one policy, UBI, but it'd be all sorts of other policies, including reductions in inequality, being more growth agnostic about and being far more focused on human and social progress. Those things, I think, are major perspective shifts and priority shifts that also need to go hand in hand with UBI for it to be effective.
I know you literally just said they have to go hand in hand. Like, do you think a paradigm shift could lead to that situation in the economy? And or if that happened in the economy, could it lead to the paradigm shift? Or do they literally have to happen at the same time?
There's going to be a point in time, I think, in the not too distant future, certainly when my kids are a bit older, where we are going to have to reckon with these issues, because not because we're shooting past human thresholds that are creating a lot of anxiety, stress, and perfectionism, but because we've breached some turning point in the climate. That means we have to reconcile with this focus of more, bigger, better. We would have to. Because something is going to happen that's going to displace millions of billions of people, which is going to create all sorts of difficulties for the developed world. And so there's a sense that there is something coming down the line at some point where we will have to rethink our emphasis and our focus. Until then, I am not necessarily overly optimistic that we are going to see significant change. But I think there is hope, and the hope is that we recognize in time that we do need to think differently about what's important and whether human and social progress is at least as important, if not more important, than economic growth, where we do realize that, you know, more doesn't always equal better, where it's really important to get on top of inequality because it's creating a drag on not just, you know, productivity, but also health and happiness, where through things like UBI, where we do have to take AI, which, by the way, is such an important innovation, has so much potential to be extremely life enhancing, but we have to make sure that the productivity gains, again, are shared. All of these things, I think, are coming down the pipeline. All of these, as I mentioned, and all of these things can be extremely positive, but it's up to us, I suppose, as a society to decide that we're going to use them to enhance our lives. And we're going to, rather than follow the path that we followed for the last 20 years, which is to try to make as much profit on the back of these things as we possibly can, whether we can actually work out how we can share the gains. And so that's my big picture. And this is why in the final chapter I tried to wrestle with, you know, what would a society where those things have changed look like? By the way, it's not a manifesto, it's not a prescription. I don't purport that any of these things should happen or could happen. I just say that let's think as a reader, I want readers to think about what would happen if any of these things were to materialize, as a way of trying to, I suppose, cement the idea that perfectionism is just as much a socially conditioned characteristic as it is a innate or personal driven characteristic. Because if we lived in a different society, which had different emphasis, then we wouldn't need as much perfectionism just to get by.
Another resource for you guys. If you struggle with food sensitivities like I do, you have got to get my app, Food Sense Guide. It's a comprehensive catalog of over 300 foods for 11 potentially problematic compounds. These include things you may be reacting to, like gluten, lectins, FODMAPs, histamine, oxalates, sulfites, thiols, whether or not something is a nightshade, and so much more. It even includes autoimmune paleo AIP status. You can learn about the compounds, create your own list to share and print, and finally take charge of your food sensitivities. It is a top Apple app, often in the top 10 for the Apple food and drinks charts. And friends, get it now, because I'm going to be updating it to a subscription basis soon. So you definitely want to get grandfathered in for life at one super low price. With the subscriptions, by the way, I'm going to be implementing some pretty cool features. So I need to do subscriptions to help support that. So like I said, get it now before we change to subscriptions. You can get it at melanieavalon.com/foodsenseguide.
Yeah, the thing I'm most curious about in the thought experiment, because actually the idea of universal basic income doesn't feel as utopian to me as the psychology side of things, which, and this is coming from my biases and perspectives and everything, but I identify as happy. Like I feel like I'm a glass half full. Like I identify as an optimist. I feel very happy. But I think one of the reasons I feel that way is because I don't expect to always feel happy. So like if I'm not happy, that doesn't really bother me. Because I know that it's just kind of like a, going back earlier with the different neurochemicals, I know it's like a roller coaster of dopamine drips. And so it's not meant to last in a way. It's supposed to be like temporary moments. And then the next one, and then the next one. And then I don't feel bad about that. Like, well, I do feel bad about that because I feel like society says I should feel bad about that. Let me clarify. I feel like society right now says that we are seeking happiness in our goals and then they don't last. And so we're never going to find happiness because we always need to just chase the next thing. However, but if you understand that, then like, what's wrong living that way? Where you're just you're just going from like happy thing to happy thing if you have like this broader picture. So what I'm thinking about in this situation that you're proposing is, will people always be driven by the next thing and growth? Is that something that literally our brain can escape or evolve beyond? Or is that just the way our brain is?
Yeah. I mean, I have arguments all the time with people within my own department who, evolutionary psychologists, who believe this is just the way we're hardwired to grow and grow and grow and grow with no limits in perpetuity forever. There's a very reasonable argument to suggest that that's the case with various different sources of data. But again, at the same time, if it was an evolved tendency, then why is it only in the last minute period of the last sort of 200 years since the Industrial Revolution that we've seen this exponential growth and this push for more and more and more? Why didn't we see this earlier? Why has this only been when it comes to the entirety of humanity, why has it only occurred in a speck of time? And again, the reason, to my mind, the reason why this sense of needing to do more, needing to have more, needing to be bigger, better, is really sparked since that time where innovation was exploded, where scarcity was manufactured into people's lives. If you go back through the centuries where capitalism started, it was really about appropriating land, creating artificial scarcity so that the commoners had to work for their subsistence. This is how capitalism began. And then, of course, there was the energy era, which meant that, work that was done by many, many people could be done by one or two people, which freed up spare capacity to drive economic activity and forward. And this drive for more, bigger, better, and this exponential curve of growth began with the advent of capitalism, which, as I said, is in a very short speck of time when it comes to humanity. So, Is it something that's hardwired within us, or is this just something that's very culturally conditioned as a function of living in capitalist societies? I lean on the latter explanation, but I don't, I'm not someone who's dogmatic about these things. I'm not somebody who would say that my perspective, the way that I read the literature or history, is the right way. I just come down on that side of the argument. And as I write in the book, if you do come down on that side of the argument, then the solutions become different to what most people would think the solutions are, which is to say, we've got to work on this as individuals. I'm saying, yeah, of course, we've got to work on ourselves as individuals. Of course we do. But also, if we really want to reduce perfectionism at a societal level, then we're also going to have to look at solutions at a societal level just as much as we are at an individual level, which is why I finished the book taking a sort of broader lens and looking at how we can live slightly differently in an economy that doesn't need to grow at all costs. And that includes some of the measures that we've discussed. So look, this has been some of the questions that you've asked have been absolutely incredible. And this is exactly the sorts of debates that we should be having on these issues. I just take a slightly different perspective to most other people, but I think that's good. I think it's healthy to have different opinions.
I'm so genuinely enjoying this. And to be completely honest, I don't typically engage in many conversations about the economy and things like that. And it's not because I don't care. It's because it's just not something I think about, and it's not something I get. I think it would just bring like more stress into my life personally. So I kind of like disengage, which kind of feels lazy. But what I was going to say about all of it is I'm so fascinated by this perfectionism concept. So it really got me engaged in all of the discussion and the narrative. And so this was like a gateway drug that like got me into thinking about the economy stuff, which I really actually appreciate. And are there examples of countries who have made shifts in paradigms that have affected economic changes and how it relates to perfectionism or happiness? And what have we seen with that? Like, is it evidence that this might work?
Well, we don't even have to look at different countries. You just have to look at within our own countries, like America and Britain. It's not so long ago that we had a very different society, much more equal society. This was kind of the post-war consensus of the New Deal in the US, where the economy looked really different. Society looked much, much different. Look, there was massive problems. Of course, there were. There's no doubt about that. But at a broad level, you know, you could raise a family on one income. House, car, kids, no problem. There was opportunities. Economy was growing at a really healthy rate. So there was opportunities not just to get jobs, but also ascend within jobs and professions. And this was, by the way, encouraged. And this is kind of the Fordist idea. And there was plenty of capacity, I suppose, for our parents' generation to really, if they worked hard, yeah, if they put the effort in, to ascend socialize. This was the affluent society, is what we're calling it, the growing middle classes. We don't have to look at different countries to know that, you know, you can have different approaches to how you manage an economy. That's changed, of course. Now we don't focus on the middle, we focus on the top, and everything is geared towards enriching those at the top because we believe that the money will trickle down and the size of the pie is way more important than how it's distributed. And of course, you know, that's created some extremely good outcomes for a small proportion of people, but it's created stagnating living standards and difficulties for many others, and particularly young people. So we don't just have to look across countries. You can look within our own countries to see that there have been times where things are different and we've had different focus and emphases. And as a consequence, to my mind anyway, you will have found far less perfectionism in, you know, in our parents' generation than we did in young people today. In fact, you know, I don't have any empirical evidence for that, but the way in which baby boomers look at young people today with complete astonishment tells us that we're very different people and our characteristics have fundamentally shifted in ways that are really profound. So it isn't just about looking at different countries. You can, of course, look at different countries. You know, Scandinavian countries have a big welfare state. They have a lot less inequality, and there's a massive safety net. So you can look at those countries. European countries follow a similar model. Even in Canada, if you go to Quebec, for example, you tend to see more social democracy in action. And as a consequence, that does have impacts on levels of perfection. Actually, that is one where we do have data, a lot lower levels of perfectionism in Quebec than anywhere else in Canada, the US. Or the UK. So, you know, it's not just about, you know, is there a system or is there a society where there's, you know, perfection really low or no? There's no such society in the developed world where you'll see that. But as I mentioned earlier, it's all about levels and degrees. And you'll have some societies where perfectionism is less needed and other societies where it's really needed. And I think that's the crux of my book. That's what I'm trying to argue, that this is just as much a cultural phenomenon as it is a personal phenomenon.
How do you think that realistically is going to continue to evolve and manifest the role of AI in all of this? And, you know, what if we end up in ultimately like some sort of, you know, virtual reality, assuming we're not in one right now?
I think AI, social media, technology is such a powerful thing, particularly like in the green growth era, you know, where we do need growth to be driven by things that don't extract and cause a great deal of pollution. You know, the technology is at the forefront of that. However, you know, you have to be a bit careful with it, right? Because we want these things to be life enhancing. We want them to meet human and social needs. You know, virtual reality, social media, these things can be really powerful at bringing people together around shared interests, social support, meeting people offline. You know, there's a sense that these things, tools, can be really powerful in terms of human experience if they're used for those things, if they're used for social comparison, consumption, and just to create a sort of aura scrambled reality into which targeted advertising thrives, well, that is not necessarily a healthy reason for the, you know, a reason for these tools to be used. So we just have to be careful about how they're used. I think that's important. It's not about throwing the baby out of the bathwater. Now, when it comes to AI, again, it's such a positive development. It can create so much economic activity, and it's going to drive a lot of growth, and it's going to take a lot of work away from us, undoubtedly. I mean, that's already happening. Now, the question is, what do we do with that work that's been taken away from us? Do we just use it to free up that time to be given more work to do? Because that's one way we could use it. Are we going to use it to eradicate our jobs altogether? In which case, you know, that's going to be really problematic in terms of demand in the economy. Or are we going to say, okay, these tools are really powerful, almost too powerful, and that we have to make sure that they're used responsibly and that we use them with a social conscience? And that's to say that, you know, it's going to free up productivity. So those productivity gains should be shared. Right? They should allow us to release us from work, to do more work if we want to, no problem with that, but also to spend more time in our families and communities if we want to. Right? I think there has to be some kind of democratic oversight of these technologies, because if there isn't, we really are into a dystopian world. But if there is some democratic oversight of how these technologies are used, and as again, just like social media, just like virtual reality, they can be very, very positive for human development and progress. But, you know, as I say, we have to use them with a social conscience.
Yeah, I think what will be so interesting to see, I was thinking about this actually yesterday, because I was using ChatGPT to write a contract. And I was thinking about how, like, growing up before AI, you really had to create, you had to like create things yourself, like doing the research. And then if you're a perfectionist, you know, try to create this perfect thing. Compared to engaging with AI, for example, I'm like, create this, and then it just creates it as almost as perfectly as it can. But then I still have the tendency in me, like it gives me back what it gives me. And then I'm like, no, I need to, you know, make this better and perfect it. So I'll be really curious, like people growing up with that, you know, this basically instant button access to almost, if not perfect, manifestations of what they're trying to create. How will that affect people's perfectionist tendencies? Will they become less because now they can just create the thing needed, or will they become more because now they're just trying to make it better and better? I guess it goes back to like, I mean, so many things, nature versus nurture. There's a lot there. I'll be really curious to see what happens, is my point.
It's exciting. It's exciting. It is exciting.
And where have you landed today with your own? Because you take readers in the book through your journey, and I promise we're wrapping up. I want to be really respectful of your time. Where are you, especially after writing the book, did you have massive evolutionary shifts in your own perfectionistic tendencies? How are you today?
It's a journey. I mean, I still am a perfectionistic person. There's no doubt about that. But the book has been really rehabilitating, I suppose. Maybe is that a word? Rehabilitative. In some ways, in terms of perfectionism, because you can't really be a perfectionist and do something like write a book or make a documentary. Do you know what I mean? Or start up a company. You know, you have to at some point be willing to let it go. That's what the perfectionistic person really struggles with. And so through the process of writing the book, it really has taught me a lot about what perfectionism is, but also what's important when it comes to overcoming perfection, which is basically letting it go. At some point, you have to accept that it's good enough, and you have to put it out into the world, and you have to, you know, we live in an information age. Unfortunately, that's just the way it is. You know, someone's going to have their say, and they're going to like it, they're not going to like it, and you're going to get good, bad feedback, and that's just the way it is. And I think your perfectionist will tell you, well, if you get really bad feedback, that's going to be catastrophic, right? Because that'll say something that's about, you know, your ability as a writer or an academic. But actually, it's complete nonsense. Like, that's not how it works at all. You put something out into the world, somebody doesn't like it, and it's nowhere near as catastrophic as what you think it is. And that's the lesson that comes from letting things go into the world. And it doesn't have to be like a massive thing, like a book. You just be a presentation. Just putting your hand up, doing a presentation at work, and going through the anxiety that comes with maybe, you know, not being the most polished thing ever, but nevertheless you did it and you put it out there. And now you can learn and grow and develop. And so that for me was the biggest lesson of the book. was not just writing it, which was hard enough, but letting it go. That's like taking a sledgehammer to perfectionism. So I'm still have, you know, moments where my perfectionism takes over a little bit, but I'm able much more to reflect on the bigger picture. And like you said earlier, you know, grow and become more aware of the problems with that kind of self-critical mindset and check myself every time I start to fall into it. So yeah, to any of your listeners, you know, perfectionism will hold you back way more than push you forward. So don't listen to that inner voice. Get something done, put it out there into the world and learn, grow, iterate through it. That's the most important thing.
Well, I love that so much. I am all about the letting go, and I can definitely see it in my own journey with even like with this show, looking back on how I handled when I first launched it, like the first episodes compared to now. And I still love it and adore it the exact same and want to always improve it. But the amount of stress I had in the beginning about getting things perfect is just ridiculous. So, well, this has been so amazing. Your book was just fascinating, so eye-opening. Cannot recommend enough that listeners check it out. We'll put links to it in the show notes. Are you writing another book now?
No, I'm not. I'm taking a bit of a break with a young child.
Oh, is it a new?
Well, not that new. They're a year old now, but
oh, that's new. That's pretty new.
Yeah, pretty new. So my next year or so, I'm going to focus on being present for my child, hopefully children, and then who knows? Yeah, like in the future, we'll see if there's another topic that I'm particularly interested in, and maybe I'll write another book. But for now, I think it's about enjoying life a little bit.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. The last question I ask every single guest on this show, and it's because I realize more and more each day how important mindset is. So what is something that you're grateful for?
Now, I'm definitely grateful for my son and my partner. I'm just wonderful parts of my life that I don't know what I would do without. So I would definitely say my family I'm most grateful for. But I'm also grateful to an incredible number of people that have helped me on my journey, in particular my PhD supervisor, whose unwavering support is the reason I'm here. My mum for pushing me to go to university when I really didn't want to. So much I'm grateful for. But yeah, I suppose if you want me to pick one thing, it would be my family.
Well, I love that so much. And I am so grateful for the work that you're doing. Like I said, I was so, so excited by the topic. And then just so grateful for all of the research that you're doing and awareness you're spreading. And I'm really, really grateful, as you said, all throughout the show, this perspective you have about, you know, engaging with critical thinking about things and having discussions and debates and understanding our biases. And I just really appreciate that, because goodness knows today in our world, it can be really hard to talk about things with people. And I just think it's so important. So thank you for everything that you're doing. I'm going to eagerly follow your work. And if you write another book in the future, I'd love to have you back on and talk about that.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. And this was honestly such a lovely interview, some amazing questions, stuff that I don't get asked often, and has certainly made me introspect and think about my own perspectives too. So this is a really nice interview. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks, Thomas. You're the best. And enjoy Canada.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information, you can check out my book, What When Wine, Lose Weight and Feel Great with Paleo-Style Meals, Intermittent Fasting, and Wine, as well as my blog, melanieavalon.com. Feel free to contact me at podcast@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.